Governor Abbott puts millions of dollars into play to help small companies amid growing pressure from some to declare Texas reopened for business. That story today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Glimmers of hope with lots of red flags. That's how the governor's characterizing the fight against coronavirus in Texas right now. But is there a plan for getting back to normal? An international artery connecting Texas to the world in a time of COVID-19, also dividing Texans themselves. And the push for vote by mail in this year's presidential election. Could Texas pull it off? Those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets rolling right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this Tuesday, the 14th of April, 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Hope your day's gotten off to at least a decent start. Question, do you have a sense that somehow we've turned the corner in this coronavirus crisis? Well, to be clear, as of this writing, the experts say we have not reached peak impact, but the consistent everyday escalation of new diagnoses and death counts has become conspicuously less consistent, both in Texas and across much of the nation. That, in conjunction with a new tug of war between President Trump and Democratic governors on the coasts over who gets to say when the country reopens, along with growing acclimation to the new routines many of us have been forced into and the financial distress many Texans are facing firsthand, has lots of folks in the Lone Star State understandably asking whether we can't just start working our way back to the old normal, starting about, oh, now might be good. Despite the reservations of health authorities, of course. One manifestation of a shift in attitudes is mounting pressure on Governor Greg Abbott to unveil a plan for what comes next. How and when will it be back to business as usual in Texas once again? It is something that the governor appears to be giving some serious thought to, even as he tries to tamp down expectations that he's preparing to lift his order for non-essential businesses to stay closed and for workers to stay home. Bob Garrett's been writing about all this for the Dallas Morning News, where he's the state capitol bureau chief. Bob, welcome back.
Thanks, David. Great to be here.
What exactly did Governor Abbott say when it comes to plans to reopen the Texas economy? Slowly, I presume?
Slowly, strategically, safely. He had about four S words in a row. He basically says he's going to use, you know, medical advice and collaborate closely with the White House, and he is about to appoint a roundtable or task force of prominent Texans who will, I suppose, lend cover or credibility to what he's going to propose. It's hard not to believe that he's kind of just buying some time, because I seriously doubt he knows what he wants to do, much less what he can sell politically, public health-wise, to a restless public in Texas. So I don't know.
Stay tuned indeed. He seems to be trying to at least address concerns in the small business community with this announcement of a $50 million small business loan relief program. What does that entail?
Well, it's part of Goldman Sachs, the investment bank in New York's 10,000 small businesses program they've had for a number of years. And they're rolling out $50 million in Texas as part of, I think, a $550 million nationwide commitment to small business loans. And they're going to just be processed the way these other ones you've been hearing about that came from the federal legislation through the Small Business Administration. But, you know, they're supposed to encourage people to keep small businesses to keep people on payroll, and they're going to be forgivable loans. $50 million, you know, David, this is a big state, and that's not going to go very far, but it's something, and Abbott certainly jumped on it as a glimmer of good news.
Is this an effort to try to deal with that pressure to open up the economy, to back off some of his orders, stay-at-home orders and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think he's in a tight spot. You know, the dominant party in Texas, Republican, is a pro-business party, but it also has a libertarian party. And has an activist base that includes, some would argue, an anti-science wing of the party. And the libertarian and the anti-science wing are very restive right now and critical of Greg Abbott and of local mayors and county judges, many of whom are Democrats in urban areas, who they think are sort of loving this power grab to tell people how to live their lives. And so there's a lot of concern that among certain staunchly conservative Republicans that Abbott's not moving fast enough to reopen the economy. But, you know, I think there's a much larger public out there that Abbott is very aware of, that is very wary of kind of going too fast, and feel the president is maybe going too fast.
Yeah, of course, the coronavirus cases continue to rise in numbers in the state, and so do unemployment claims. President Trump said he was going to be the one who determines how states will reopen. National media made a big thing out of this yesterday. Do you think any of this back and forth between the governors and President Trump could interfere with Governor Abbott's own plans?
Well, as you know, Abbott has really stroked Trump, and Trump has, in response to questions from my colleague Todd Gilman in Washington at the White House, has praised Greg Abbott to the skies as a terrific governor. It's been sort of a model of how a Republican red state governor stays on the good side of the White House. You know, once push comes to shove, and if Trump is pushing for something that Abbott really feels could be unsafe or could be in the long term injurious to both his political well-being and that of his party, then you might see a divide. But so far, Abbott's been able to paper it over.
Bob Garrett is the Austin Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. We'll link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Bob, thanks again.
My pleasure, David.
As many governors across the U.S. instituted de facto lockdowns to slow the spread of the coronavirus in recent weeks, Governor Abbott's faced pressure to be more assertive, to take sweeping executive action in order to get Texans to stay at home. But many of Governor Abbott's critics also believe some of his executive orders have gone too far, and now the governor's authority is facing legal challenges with implications that just might linger long after the coronavirus crisis. Here to help us understand what's going on, Stephen Vladeck. He's constitutional law scholar and professor at the University of Texas Law School. Professor, good to have you back on the Texas Standard.
Thanks, David. Always great to be with you.
There are two executive orders that the governor seems to be getting a whole lot of legal pushback on. One has to do with whether or not the state can halt most abortion procedures during this pandemic. What exactly did the governor specifically call for that got abortion tangled up in all of this?
Yeah, so the governor's underlying executive order is actually a limitation on all non-essential or elective medical procedures. The idea being that procedures that can be done 6, 8, 10 months from now, we really should put them off so that we're not straining hospital resources, staff, etc. And then Attorney General Paxton issued an opinion where he interpreted that executive order to also apply to most abortions. Never mind that for obvious reasons, abortions are obviously time sensitive. And so putting them off 6 or 8 months means, for most women, not having them. So this has already gone up to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals twice. Judge Yackel here in Austin had put a temporary restraining order on the entire executive order as applied to abortions. The Fifth Circuit reversed that last week. Then Judge Yackel issued a narrower temporary restraining order where he said at least as applied to medicinal abortions, that is to say, abortions that don't require any medical procedure. This is still invalid. And actually, late last night, the Fifth Circuit agreed with Judge Yackel and refused the governor's request to put that decision on hold. So at least for now, medicinal abortions in Texas can go forward, but surgical abortions cannot.
I wonder what that does to Supreme Court claim that some of the abortion providers were pushing. They had said that Texas has tried to exploit the COVID-19 crisis as a kind of pretext to target abortion.
That argument, I think, at least has some force when we look at the range of other measures that the state has not pursued. I mean, we're still one of the handful of states without a true statewide shelter-in-place rule. You know, we have sort of a limited one. But I do think, I mean, David, I think it probably does take the wind out of the sails in the Supreme Court, because I think from the Supreme Court's perspective, the providers have now gotten, at least for the moment, much of the relief they had been seeking. And, you know, I think this probably means this case now stays in the lower courts, at least for the time being, where medicinal abortions go forward, non-medicinal abortions are paused, but maybe mm-hmm. things get revisited after next week when the first of the governor's orders expires.
There's another legal tug of war over whether certain low-level offenders can be released from certain county lockups without paying bail. Tell us a little bit about what Governor Abbott was trying to do with that executive order. No cash bail for certain inmates.
Yeah, so I think the concern here, the cutting in both directions, right? From the inmate's perspective, the concern is that these jails and prisons are, you know, breeding environments for COVID-19 and for the spread of the virus. And mm-hmm. so, you know, folks who don't need to be held shouldn't be held. The governor's position, on the other hand, is that without cash bail, there's no guarantee that these folks are going to come back, right? That, you know, they have to have some skin in the game to justify the release. Not hard to see, David, how that disproportionately impacts those prisoners and inmates, you know, who are poor, who can't afford to pay for bail. So this case is already up in the Texas Supreme Court. This one's in state court. A state court judge had put a temporary restraining order on Governor Abbott's measure, but the Supreme Court of Texas has actually granted a stay of that mm-hmm. restraining order. So basically the governor's edict is in effect for the moment. We're expecting a ruling on the merits from the Supreme Court, you know, as early as today and certainly sometime this week.
And you say Supreme Court, just to be clear again, you're talking about the state Supreme Court in this case.
I'm sorry, yeah. So the bail case is in the state court. That's right.
Steve Vladeck is constitutional law scholar and professor at the University of Texas School of Law. Professor Vladeck, thanks again.
Thank you. Be safe.
Glimmer of hope, but with red flags. That's what the Texas governor is saying about the situation in Texas. Wells Dunbar, social media editor. What are Texans saying about the situation now?
Well, we're hearing from our friends and listeners about what it might actually mean to reopen the economy and whether, as he claims, President Trump would even have the power to. On Facebook, Rosemary Higgs says, since Trump abdicated the power to close businesses and left it up to governors, he shouldn't have any say on when to reopen. He did too little too late, and now he wants to undo what governors have done. Craig Anders York writes, Trump probably seeks to coerce enough Republican governors into relaxing social distancing rules to open large swaths of the manufacturing and service sectors, regardless of the risk. And this comment from Jod Huddleston, interesting one. It goes, thinking that people are going to go back to the way things were is wrong. How can we? Will we suddenly forget that we could catch a life-threatening illness or forget that we didn't get paid for several months while our bills continue to mount? Definitely some concerns that folks have out there, David. I'll be back with more reactions later in the show.
Yeah, this push and pull over who has the power, me or me. What do you think? Is that a substantive argument? Is it primarily a lot of show with nothing behind it? We'd love to hear from you, Texas. Tweet us at Texas Standard. Look for us on the social media platform of your picking. Wells Dunbar is looking for you. He'll be back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. It's no doubt been a challenge for many Texans to find and or maintain a sense of humor during this pandemic. After all, a health crisis is no laughing matter. But a little levity can go a long way toward helping some folks cope during times of fear and uncertainty. And Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan discovered an artist who's willing to offer some relief.
It comes from a guy whose career work isn't terribly humorous.
I'm a lab manager at a local university.
But it's what Rafael Gonzalez Jr. has done with his art that's pretty interesting. A recent focus? Loteria cards.
Mexican Loteria is popular in Mexico and of course in the Mexican American communities in the United States. We grow up playing it with families at different events.
Think bingo, but with cards, each with a number, a picture, and a label as to what the card represents. What Gonzalez has done is to create a COVID-19-based loteria.
I'd just like to bring a new take on the old images during this pandemic.
And so he's taken coronavirus themes and reimagined them in loteria cards.
So the first one was the actual image of the coronavirus.
It's that distinctive circular thing with red spikes. We can't tell you what it's called because it straddles the line between humor and borderline obscene. But you can see it at tpr.org. And there's more.
People were hoarding toilet paper, so people are still having trouble finding it. So I just put a stack of rolls together and call it El Hoarder.
From El Hoarder, we go to La Coping Mechanism, a frozen margarita.
I'm a lover of margaritas and tequila, and not being able to go out and enjoy one with chips and salsa at restaurants, I've turned into a sort of my own mixologist here at home.
El Trabajo, the job. It shows a laptop dialed to Zoom. In other words, working from home. He doesn't have 54 of them yet, which is the standard Loteria deck, but prints and t-shirts are available. I'm Jack Morgan in San Antonio.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a health and safety-focused workers' compensation provider, reminding Texans that the best way to stick together right now is to stay apart. More at texasmutual.com/coronavirus.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. On a map, Interstate 35 looks like an artery. It touches both our southern border with Mexico and our northern border with Canada. Even during COVID-19, I-35 is a bloodline. Everything from produce to medical equipment travels on it freely. I-35 is a connector of three countries, but it is also a divider. Texas state demographer Lloyd Potter says I-35 breaks up the state unevenly.
If you were to count all of the population along I-35 and east of it, it's 87% of our population, meaning that only 13% is west of I-35.
The Standard's Joy Diaz reports on those differences between east and west in the Texas capital.
It's early morning and west of I-35. This is what you hear. Not a single person is up. At least not where I can see. The streets are empty. There's no movement.
Yeah, everybody is sleeping at 535.
East of I-35, the story changes. Daniel Perez, the man who was speaking with me that early morning, was definitely not sleeping. He was east of I-35 on his truck, ready to get busy installing kitchen cabinets. Like him, many others were already out and about and underway to their jobs in this part of town. Salvador, a man who is unauthorized to work in the U.S., tells me in Spanish that he does roofing. We talked outside a grocery store in East Austin, one that opens at 6 to cater to workers like Salvador or like Erika.
Limpieza.
Erika is also unauthorized to work in the U.S., and she works for a house cleaning service. We talked as she stopped to grab something to eat. For her, work starts at 7. Whereas the early morning in West Austin felt like a bubble suspended in peaceful bliss, East Austin felt busy, as though COVID-19 did not exist. Andrew Robertson, for instance, was grabbing some orange juice at McDonald's when he told me he works for Austin's Waste Management.
You see me, I'm basically on the front line every day, and I haven't got no pension for it. I mean, I'm not even given a mask, but I touch everybody's recycle and trash cans.
Think about it. The only weapons against COVID-19 are staying home, washing hands, and wearing masks. And Robertson is not afforded any of these protections. So why are so many people east of the highway working? And why is the highway the dividing line? It's a historic thing, says Elliot Treader, the author of Shadows of a Sunbelt City, The Environment, Racism, and the Knowledge Economy in Austin.
I-35 became a monument, basically, to separate white Austin and the non-white Austin. Some people call it the dual city or the apartheid city.
Treader says I-35, the highway turned into the divider, is one of many that were built in the 50s and 60s to connect, but also to divide. They were tools for segregation. But no monument can stop COVID-19 from going east or going west. This killer attacks both rich and poor, the famous and the lesser known. So why not provide the necessary protections to everyone in the face of the pandemic?
I mean, I think it's very complicated, right? And it gets into all these thorny issues about environmental hazards and vulnerability, and we often just sort of accept those as just part of the course of, you know, how we build cities, from exposure to pollution on highways to, you know, lead paint to where people live to who has the right to live and die.
It is complicated. Over the last few weeks, the global community has embraced a mantra that says, we're all in this together. Are we? No, but we can be, says Democratic State Representative Donna Howard. Her district covers parts of East and West Austin, and she says her hope is that in the end, COVID-19 will be the catalyst to many structural reforms, including immigration reform.
Now we're seeing, it's in our faces, these people, especially if you've got food on your table, these are the people that are there making sure that food supply chain is continuing to function. And we need to make sure that we support these people who allow us to enjoy the life that we have and to have food on our table.
As I returned to the safety of my West Austin home, the only thing that I could hear was a montage of birds and song. I thought about the workers whose lives Howard hopes to change. Delivery workers, sanitation workers, construction workers, nurses. Texas has called them essential workers, but as one person recently put it, instead of essential, we feel disposable. The hope to change that exists. Will hope transform into action? I'm Joy Diaz for the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard's working with public radio stations across the state to track confirmed cases of the coronavirus in Texas. You can find the Texas Newsroom's interactive map on our own website. You can get there directly by going to texasstandard.org/COVID-maps. Coming up on 29 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard time. The roundup's next. Stay with us.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The state's top oil and gas regulators this morning are considering how restricting production could help the struggling industry. Some smaller energy companies are asking the Texas Railroad Commission to cut statewide output to help boost oil prices, which have dropped significantly. During a teleconference, Commission Chairman Wayne Christian said thousands of oil and gas industry jobs in Texas are threatened by the economic downturn spurred by the global coronavirus pandemic.
The Railroad Commission is listening during this time of unprecedented problems in the oil patch. You know, who'd have thunk a month ago that we'd be facing this type of dilemma?
The commission could vote on cutting production for the first time since 1973, as early as next week. The top official for Dallas County says at least 10 people have died from COVID-19 in the last 24 hours. That's the most deaths the county has reported in a single day since it began tracking the pandemic. County Judge Clay Jenkins says while that is cause for concern, there are also reasons to be optimistic.
What our medical modeling is showing from Medical City, UT Southwestern, and Baylor, all those models are showing that our safer at home model that was first instituted on March 22nd is bearing fruit. We're flattening the curve. So that's giving us cause for optimism and hope.
Jenkins was speaking with the Texas Tribune this morning. Dallas County has the second highest number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in the state behind Harris County. Houston Rockets guard Russell Westbrook is donating 650 computers to local students to help them access their classwork online while schools are closed. The NBA star's Why Not Foundation is partnering with the Mayor's Office of Education and CompuDopt, a nonprofit that works to get technology to underserved youth. Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner explained during a news conference Monday there is a great need for this type of resource in the area.
In Houston's largest school districts, nearly 140,000 households do not have a computer, and over 200,000 households do not have internet access. We're working on both of those.
Public schools in Texas have been closed statewide since mid-March. And 50 years ago today, an oxygen tank explosion severely damaged the Apollo 13 spacecraft while en route to the moon, putting the lives of its three-man crew in peril. The crew's commander, astronaut Jim Lovell, says the key to their survival was staying calm while working with the team on the ground in Houston to address each challenge as it presented itself.
When the explosion occurred, if we had gotten in sort of a waiting for a miracle, did nothing but wait for a miracle, would we still be up there waiting for that miracle to happen?
The Apollo 13 crew safely splashed down in the Pacific Ocean days later on April 17, 1970. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard time. I'm David Brown. Calling any and all armchair economists, I want you to listen closely. Beef prices in the grocery stores are going up. Cattle prices ranchers get from selling cows are going down. So what's going on here? Of course, the answer isn't just one single thing, but one of those things might be market manipulation by the massive meatpacking companies responsible for bringing beef from the pasture to your plate. That's the allegation levied by State Representative Drew Springer, at least. He's a Republican from Munster in North Texas, and he is chair of the House Agriculture and Livestock Committee. Representative Springer, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hey, David, it's great to be on.
Four companies, as I understand it, control 85% of the beef packing market in the United States. And you wrote a letter recently to the Attorney General, Ken Paxton, asking him to look into price fixing by those companies. What led you to that?
Well, it was really two parts. And it was probably highlighted by the coronavirus and the fact that while the cattle industry has been seeing their prices paid to the rancher go down significantly, we were seeing large increases in the grocery store. When I talked to one of the owners of the grocery store, they said, well, you know, it's not us. Our wholesale prices have increased 20-25%. You know, and during the pandemic, you know, we have laws against price gouging. Right. But we'd heard about market manipulation. And so while we were talking about that, we said, if we're going to open an investigation on this to see if there's any violations, we need to include that as well. And so we're going to take a look at both aspects of it.
Well, now, I suppose that some people listening to us might say, well, listen, there could be another explanation here. You talk about, you know, the coronavirus. Could be just an imbalance of supply and demand right now. I mean, when you compare the retail level with the wholesale level. In other words, maybe more people are buying beef at the retail level right now, driving up prices, because after all, we've seen a lot of stockpiling. But maybe you have too much supply at the wholesale level that's also driving down what ranchers can demand. So I'm just wondering if this isn't a matter of the two markets kind of not having equilibrium right now while the economy is sort of upside down.
And there's no doubt. And that's why we're saying we're going to investigate, not calling it absolutely today that there's a violation. But, you know, the same thing goes for, you know, a guy owns a gas station and during a hurricane and says, I've got 10,000 gallons and I know the demand is much greater than what the supply is. And so therefore, to try to ration that, I'm going to increase prices. But at the same time, you know, one of the challenges that we see, though, from the market perspective of buying from the cattlemen at auctions is you don't have all four packers showing up at every auction to buy. In fact, almost exclusively, you only see one show up at any given auction to buy. And, you know, that has had ranchers talking for, you know, at least a couple years about, you know, the inequities that they're seeing in this marketplace. And it's not only me. I know the Attorney General in Montana has called for more oversight and looking into this. I know the chairman of the livestock agriculture industry for the U.S. Congressional, Colin Peterson, has basically written a letter to Attorney General Barr asking for the same investigation. So it's a bipartisan view of saying we need to look at this industry.
Have you talked with anyone from the meatpackers about this? And what have they had to say?
You know, I have talked to a couple of their representatives and, you know, they say, look, it's market volatility. There's plant closures. There's, you know, just imbalances. We've heard some of those things. Nobody has had a really good explanation of why they overnight increased wholesale prices 25% to the retailers. But on the other side of it, you know, there are a bunch of moving parts. I was on a call with American Farm Bureau economist. And, you know, they talk about a lot of changes and the fact that a plant last year had a fire could have affected this. You know, I think we've just got to drill down into this, though, and make sure that we can put people's mind at ease, that we have a fair and free market system that is working for everybody. And there are definitely risks that the ranchers have always faced, and they're willing to face that as long as they know that they're facing a fair market.
Have you heard anything back from the AG's office on your request?
I have, and the AG's office is looking into both aspects, both from consumer protection, which would be the price gouging aspect, as well as antitrust and the fact that, you know, when four folks control 85% of the market, we really want to make sure that that is a fair market that is working like a free market, not manipulated.
Sounds like there's a whole lot more to this story one way or the other. State Representative Drew Springer is a Republican from Munster and chair of the House Agriculture and Livestock Committee. Representative Springer, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, David. It's been my pleasure.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
My name is Megan Murphy, and I live with my husband and my two teenage children in the Round Rock area. I was diagnosed last June with breast cancer, and I've either been in surgery or chemotherapy or radiation since then. So it's a long journey, but typical for breast cancer, I believe. It's quite stressful just going to cancer treatments just without the virus. So having cancer treatments at the same time of the virus and at stay-at-home orders certainly, in my case, increased the stress of going, and I would imagine other patients as well. What was helpful is the healthcare workers really remain calm, and they make us feel safe by using lots of extra precautions. They certainly always wear gowns and gloves, but then everybody was wearing masks, sanitizing everything constantly. They did a deep clean at night. There was a nurse there to take our temperature and give us antibacterial and then go into the waiting room. And they also limited, we were going in just by ourselves. These nurses and doctors and staff are going in every day, all day, and seeing many, many patients, and really putting their lives on the line with this virus to get us through our treatment that we really need to help save our lives. So I was blessed with this, that these people just kept coming and they were so calm. You would never know that there was a crisis when you walk in this office, which was so helpful. I think what's strange is when I was having surgery and chemotherapy, those of us who have gone through that, we already did self-isolate for our own health so that we weren't going to the grocery store and you're not going in big crowds. And so I'd been doing that for a long time. And so now getting close to the end for me, I was looking forward to doing those things again. And now we can't. You know, certainly what I've learned is I think we're all in fear and we're all have increased stress. But I think if we just take it slow and do everything you can, we can conquer this fear and really hopefully help everybody around us. My name is Megan Murphy, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
On this day 85 years ago, the 14th of April, 1935, Texans in the Panhandle left their goggles and face masks at home. It was Palm Sunday, and for the first time in a long time, the skies were clear.
There's a nickname for that period among folks who live there. They call the period the Dirty 30s.
That's Mark Fernandez, chair of the History Department at Loyola University, New Orleans. This was the Dust Bowl. Years of drought and overgrazing on the Great Plains meant that for most of the 30s, dust seemed to be everywhere, all the time, caked in nostrils, piled up on windshield wipers, drizzling from cracks in clapboard ceilings. It could collect in lungs and cause lethal dust pneumonia. And in Texas, the Panhandle was the area that was most affected. Day-to-day life continued as much as it could.
It is what it is. That was their attitude.
That's Louise George, a Panhandle historian who grew up during the Dust Bowl.
They didn't waste time feeling sorry for themselves because they had to make a living for those kids.
By and large, the people of the Panhandle then were not overly prosperous. They were farmers and ranchers, mostly. Some worked in the oil fields. Others made do with whatever odd jobs they could find, including an up-and-coming singer-songwriter from Pampa named Woody Guthrie.
A dust storm hit, and it hit like thunder. It dusted us over, and it covered us under. Blocked out the traffic and blocked out the sun. Straight for home all the people did run, singing so.
Guthrie was born in Oklahoma, but he moved to Pampa in his early 20s to help his father run a boarding house there. Dust storms had become routine for Guthrie and his neighbors by 1935. But the one that hit on April 14th was something else entirely. The clear morning passed into an equally pleasant day, but by early evening, people could see something dark and massive billowing on the horizon.
This one was different. It was hideous.
It was the biggest, most menacing storm yet. The cloud of black dust had formed earlier that day over the Dakotas, picking up strength and dirt as it rolled southwest. By the time it reached the Panhandle, the storm was over 1,000 miles long, literally blocking out the sun. There was a scramble to get inside, at home if possible, or in somebody else's if not. People would douse the outside of their house with water to make the dust cling to the exterior. They'd cram newspapers into door frames and windowsills. It only helped so much.
There are numerous accounts, including Woody's own account. It was so powerful that when the storm hit, in the room they were kind of huddled in, there was only one light bulb hanging from the ceiling. And the dust penetrated the house so heavily that Woody Guthrie described the looking at the light where it was only as bright as the glow of a cigarette.
Families sat together in small, dark rooms and waited. There was nothing else to do.
I remember how eerie the silence was. Nobody had anything to say.
There was a sense that perhaps this was it, that on this Sunday evening in April, assailed on all sides by a darkness that felt relentless.
They were afraid that the world was going to end.
We talked of the end of the world, and then we'd sing a song and then sing it again. We'd sit for an hour and not say a word, and then these words would be heard. So long, it's been good to know ye. So long, it's been good to know ye. So long, it's been good to know ye. This dusty old dust is a-getting my home, and I've got to be drifting along.
It was a day that came to be known as Black Sunday. When it was over, people stepped out of their homes the next morning. They saw fences buried in dirt, livestock choked dead by dust, tractors submerged in sand. The economic loss was devastating. Thousands of families left to look for work elsewhere. Louise George's father left the family farm in the Panhandle for life in Oklahoma. This was at the tail end of the Great Depression. Getting back on your feet wasn't easy. Black Sunday would be seared in the collective memory of the Great Plains. Recovery didn't happen overnight, but it happened.
It took a while, but we were okay after the Depression. We made it.
And the world hadn't ended, after all.
Our relatives were huddled into their oil boom shacks. And the children, they was crying as it whistled through the cracks.
and the family. Well, a well-known name in Texas politics is leaving her post at the U.S. Department of the Interior less than a year after Senate confirmation. Susan Combs, a former Texas controller and ag commissioner, announced she's leaving her position as U.S. Interior Assistant Secretary for Policy, Management, and Budget effective April 25th. In the past, as a rancher and state official, she's championed private property rights and opposed many endangered species regulations. No explanation yet for her decision to return to Texas, though she spent less time in her Interior Department gig than she did waiting for confirmation. When we learn more, we'll share it right here on The Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In Texas, casting a ballot by mail is allowed under very limited circumstances. It's something reserved for senior citizens, disabled individuals, or someone who must prove that they would be unable to vote in their county on Election Day. But concerns about the spread of the coronavirus has many people asking, what would it take for Texas and other states with more strict absentee ballot regulations to loosen up a bit? Here to talk with us about that is Jessica Hoosman. She is a reporter for ProPublica who writes about voting rights and procedures. Jessica, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
What's the history of vote by mail? I would guess that maybe the military had something to do with it or no?
Yeah, so votes started being sent out by mail as early as during the Civil War when folks were on the battlefield and couldn't vote from home, and has sort of expanded from there. The California in the 80s was the first state to open up vote by mail to larger populations, and it's sort of grown in popularity since. And right now there are 5 states that do all vote by mail. So they conduct their elections entirely by mail.
It was interesting because I've heard this described as sort of like all mail elections. In other words, the emphasis is on doing your elections by mail, and then you also have the option of going down to the courthouse or down to the schoolhouse and casting your ballot on that day. And there, you say there are 5 states that have all mail, is that right?
Yes, that is Utah, Hawaii, Oregon, Washington, and Colorado. And so those states have really sort of led the way here and have a lot of sophisticated technology around tracking your ballot and counting your ballot and processing all of the paper that it requires.
If it works for these states, why is it something that all the states haven't embraced? Why just these 5 states?
So there are a lot of complicated answers to that question that are all basically basically have the same weight. So not every state is set up in such a way that they could centralize operations like that. So, for example, in Texas, the counties are entirely in charge of their own elections. It would take a huge culture shift in Texas for us to get on a statewide page around one system of voting. And then also, you know, vote by mail is not as simple as, you know, popping a ballot in an envelope and sending it to you and you sending it back. That's a ton of paper. For example, one 18-wheeler truck holds about 250,000 ballots. So if we're talking about a city of several million people, then you can think about the sort of sheer physical size of the ballots that would be returned. And if we are instituting a vote by mail system, the only thing we're mailing out is not a ballot, right? We've got to do applications for mailed ballots and then voter information pamphlets and instructions and envelopes. And all of those things have to be appropriately sized and in the right paperweight to be processed through USPS and get redirected. States that have rolled this out on a statewide basis have done it over a period of several years. Mm-hmm. So in Washington State, for example, it took about 6 years to ramp up fully. And that's buying the very expensive machines that do things like stuff and open envelopes and to making better connections with USPS so that we can ensure that USPS is processing ballots differently than they process other pieces of equipment. So, you know, shifting a state to vote by mail when it's not yet ready to do vote by mail can actually disenfranchise lots of people.
By the way, as a legal matter, what would it take if Texas wanted to make the leap? Would you have to convene the legislature or what would that involve?
You would have to convene the legislature and it would require require a level of organization that I don't know is politically possible right now. And it would be more than convening the legislature. It would be convening the legislature, having them change the rules, and also disperse millions of dollars for this. I mean, if Harris County, for example, went all mail-in, it would be, we're not talking about, you know, grabbing paper stock off of the shelf in Office Depot. We're talking about something that could cost as much as, you know, in the tens of millions of dollars just to serve Harris County. So, you know, the federal government has recently released $400 million for the entire country. That won't even cover the cost of the paper.
This is a hugely complicated issue, and Jessica Huseman has been reporting on this for ProPublica. We'll have a link to her latest over at texasstandard.org. Jessica, thanks so much for sharing some of your expertise with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar joins us once again with the talk of Texas. What you seeing out there, Wells?
Hey, David. A whole lot of vote-by-mail reactions coming in online, David, perhaps not too surprisingly. We heard about some of the issues there, but many of our friends and listeners still solidly in favor. Here's a sampling of what we're seeing on our Facebook page. Nicole LeBlanc writes, if mail-in ballots are acceptable for some, then why not all? I agree there may be an infinitesimal risk of fraud, but enfranchising every single voter is well worth that risk. And Christopher Waters writes that President Trump has openly admitted that allowing people to vote by mail would result in fewer Republicans getting elected. You'd think that Republicans would just adjust their platform to attract voters, but they would rather cheat the system, Christopher writes. And Janice Sprinks says that I know people whose mail has been lost or stolen. It's happened to me a few times as well, but it's an option and it usually gets where it needs to go.
Yeah, I forgive me. I was thinking, yeah. You probably heard me breathing here. I was thinking when we were getting ready to talk to our guest there, I thought this has become so politicized.
Right.
Where do you go for the information, sort of the straight up, what are the advantages, what are the disadvantages? I actually found something that maybe people would be interested in. There's this organization called the National Conference of State Legislatures, which basically is an organization of as it sounds, state legislatures that have been considering this issue. And there's a fascinating webpage. Maybe I'll get it over to our folks at texasstandard.org and see if we can't share that along with our listeners, because it really does lay this out without the politics sort of weighing everything down so people can think about this, because it really is a complicated issue.
Definitely so, and it's one of those issues that, unfortunately, it seems that in the era of the coronavirus, things that you wouldn't ordinarily would think would be politicized are increasingly so. So obviously a very difficult, nuanced issue. Well, speaking of similar issues, we're continuing to see a lot of reaction to this question we explored earlier in the program, this discussion about reopening the economy, what that even means and what it would look like, continuing to see a wide range of responses. Here. Jerry Harp on our Facebook page says, I think it is time to judiciously begin reopening selected areas of the economy with appropriate precautions while strongly encouraging the more vulnerable to maintain social distancing until a vaccine is widely available. And obviously reopening, jobs, businesses, and the like would also involve reopening schools, part of reopening society more broadly. Interesting comment here from Melinda LaRue Marshall. She says, I'm a teacher in a public school. I have a compromised immune system. Being socially distant in a classroom or hallways between passing periods is not possible. I worry about going back to the classroom too soon, and yet I'm not sure how parents will get back to work if their kids cannot go to school. Obviously an intertwined issue there for facing the country and the state, David.
A lot of moving parts, Texas. And of course, this is something that the governor has said it's going to be rolling out slow, so there is more to come. Keep it here for the very latest. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but we'll be back here tomorrow. Hope you can join us. Till then, I'm David, along with Wells and the crew, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.